Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Letter 46 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon, read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, Cairo, October 9, 1864. Dearest Alec, I have not written for a long time because I have had a fever. Now I am all right again, only weak. If you can come, please bring the books in enclosed list for an American Egyptologist at Luxor, a friend of mine. My best love to Janet and my other chicks. I wish I could see my Maurice. Tell Janet that Hassan Donkey Boy has married a girl of 11, and Phillips that Hassan remembers him quite tenderly and is very proud of having had his face drawn by him. Certainly he was of the friends, if not a brother of the Sitt. He so loved the things of the Arabs. I went to the Harim soiree at Hassan's before the wedding. At that event I was ill. My good doctor was up the river, and Hekekian Bay is in Italy, so I am very lonely here. The weather is bad, so very damp. I stream with perspiration more than in June at Luxor, and I don't like civilization so very much. It keeps me awake at night in the grog shops, and rings horrid bells, and fights and quarrels in the streets, and disturbs my Muslim nerves till I utter such epithets as kelb, dog, and consier, pig, against the Frangi, and I wish I were in a beastly Arab quarter. End of letter 46, read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 47 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon, read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Austin, Cairo, October 21st, 1864. Dearest Mutter, I got your letter yesterday. I hope Alec got mine of 2 weeks ago before leaving, and told you I was better. I am still rather weak. However, I ride my donkey, and the weather has suddenly become gloriously dry and cool. I rather shiver with the thermometer at 79 degrees. Absurd, is it not? But I got so used to real heat. I never wrote about my leaving Luxor or my journey, for our voyage was quite tempestuous after the first 3 days, and I fell ill as soon as I was in my house here. I hired the boat for 6 purses, £18, which had taken Greeks up to Aswan, selling groceries and strong drinks, but the Rais would not bring back their cargo of black slaves to dirty the boat, and picked us up at Luxor. We sailed at daybreak, having waited all 1 day, because it was an unlucky day. As I sat in the boat, people kept coming to ask whether I was coming back, very anxiously, and bringing fresh bread, eggs, and things as presents, and all the quality came to take leave and hope, inshallah, I should soon come home to my village safe and bring the master, please God, to see them, and then to say the Fatah for a safe journey and my health. In the morning the balconies of my house were filled with such a group to see us sail, a party of wild Abada with their long Arab guns and flowing hair, a Turk elegantly dressed, Mohammed in his decorous brown robes with snow-white turban, and several fellaheen. As the boat moved off, the Ababda blazed away with their guns, and Osman Effendi with a sort of blunderbuss, and as we dropped down the river there was a general firing. Even Todoros, Theodore, the Coptic Malim, popped off his American revolver. Omar keeping up a return with Alec's old horse pistols, which are much admired here on account of the excessive noise they make. Poor old Ishmael, who always thought I was Madame Balzoni and wanted to take me up to Abu Simbel to meet my husband, was in dire distress that he could not go with me to Cairo. He declared he was still Shadid, strong enough to take care of me and to fight. He is 97 and only remembers 50 or 60 years ago and old wild times, a splendid old man, handsome and erect. I used to give him coffee and listen to his stories, which had won his heart. His grandson, the quiet, rather stately Mohammed, who is guard of the house I lived in, forgot all his Muslim dignity, broke down in the middle of his set speech, and flung himself down and kissed and hugged my knees and cried. He had got some notion of impending ill luck, I found, and was unhappy at our departure, and the bakshish failed to console him. Sheikh Yusuf was to come with me, but a brother of his just wrote word that he was coming back from the Hejaz, where he had been with the troops and where he is serving his time. I was very sorry to lose his company. Fancy how dreadfully irregular for one of the ulema and a heretical woman to travel together. What would our bishop say to a parson who did such a thing? We had a lovely time on the river for 3 days, such moonlight nights, so soft and lovely, and we had a sailor who was as good as a professional singer, and who sang religious songs, which I observe excite people here far more than love songs. One which began, "Remove my sins from before thy sight, O God," was really beautiful and touching, and I did not wonder at the tears which ran down Omar's face. A very pretty, profane song, which was, "Keep the wind from me, O Lord, I fear it will hurt me." Wind means love, which is like the simoom. "Alas, it has struck me, and I am sick. Why do you bring the physician? O physician, put back thy medicine in the canister, for only he who has hurt can cure me." The masculine pronoun is always used instead of she in poetry, out of decorum, sometimes even in conversation. October 23rd. Yesterday I met a Saidi, a friend of the brother of the Sheikh of the Wild Ababda, and as we stood handshaking and kissing our fingers in the road, some of the Anglo-Indian travellers passed and gazed with fierce disgust. The handsome Hassan, being black, was such a flagrant case of a native. Mother dear, it is heartbreaking to see what we are sending to India now. The mail days are dreaded. We never know when some outrage may not excite Mussulman fanaticism. The English tradesmen here complain as much as anyone, and I, who, as the Qadi of Luxor said, am not outside the family, of Ishmael, I presume, hear what the Arabs really think. There are also crowds like lice, as one Mohammed said, of low Italians, French, etc., and I find my stalwart Hassan's broad shoulders no superfluous port respect in the Frangi quarter. 3 times I have been followed and insolently stared at, à mon âge, and once Hassan had to speak. Fancy how dreadful to Muslims! I hate the sight of a hat here now. I can't write more now, as my eyes are weak still. Omar begs me to give you his best salam and say, inshallah, he will take great care of your daughter, which he most zealously and tenderly does. End of letter 47. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 48 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Austin. On the Nile, Friday, December 23, 1864. Dearest Mother, here I am again between Beni Suf and Minia, and already better for the clear air of the river and the tranquil boat life. I will send you my Christmas salam from Siut. While Alec was with me, I had as much to do as I was able and could not write, for there was much to see and talk about. I think he was amused, but I fear he felt the Eastern life to be very poor and comfortless. I have got so used to having nothing that I had quite forgotten how it would seem to a stranger. I am quite sorry to find how many of my letters must have been lost from Luxor. In future I shall trust the Arab post, which certainly is safer than English travellers. I send you my long plaits by Alec, for I had cut my hair short, as it took to falling out by handfuls after my fever, and moreover it is more convenient Turkish harem fashion. Please tell Dean Stanley how his old dragoman, Mohammed Ghazawi, cried with pleasure when he told me he had seen Sheikh Stanley's sister on her way to India, and the little ladies knew his name and shook hands with him, which evidently was worth far more than the bakshish. I wondered who Sheikh Stanley could be, and Mohammed, who is a darwish and very pious, told me he was the Ghassis, priest, who was imam, spiritual guide, to the son of our queen, and in truth, said he is really a sheikh, and one who teaches the excellent things of religion. Why, he was kind even to his horse, and it is of the mercies of God to the English that such a one is the imam of your queen and prince. I said, laughing, "How dost thou, a darweesh among Muslims, talk thus of a Nazarene priest?" "Truly, O lady," he answered, "one who loveth all the creatures of God, him God loveth also, there is no doubt of that. Is any one bigot enough to deny that Stanley has done more for real religion in the mind of that Muslim darweesh than if he had baptized 100 savages out of one fanatical faith into another?" There is no hope of a good understanding with Orientals until Western Christians can bring themselves to recognize the common faith contained in the two religions. The real difference consists in all the class of notions and feelings, very important ones, no doubt, which we derive not from the Gospels at all, but from Greece and Rome, and which, of course, are altogether wanting here. Alec will tell you how curiously Omar illustrated the patriarchal feelings of the East by entirely dethroning me in favor of the Master. That our Master, we all eat bread from his hand, and he worked for us. Omar and I were equal before our Sadie. He can sit at ease at my feet, but when the Master comes in he must stand reverently, and give me to understand that I too must be respectful. I have got the boat of the American Mission at an outrageous price, £60, but I could get nothing under. The consolation is that the sailors profit, poor fellows, and get treble wages. My crew are all Nubians. Such a handsome Rais and steersman, brothers, and there is a black boy, of 14 or so, with legs and feet so sweetly beautiful as to be quite touching. At least I always feel those lovely, round, young, innocent forms to be somehow affecting. Our old boat of last summer, Arthur Taylor's, is sailing in company with us, and stately old Rais Mubarak hails me every morning with the blessings of God and the peace of the Prophet. Ali Kuptan, my steamboat captain, will announce our advent at Thebes. He passed us today. This boat is a fine sailer, but iron-built and therefore noisy, and not convenient. The crew here encourage her with "Get along, father of three," because she has three sails, whereas two is the usual number. They are active, good-humored fellows, my men, but lack the Arab courtesy and simpatico ways, and then I don't understand their language, which is pretty and sounds a little like Kafri, rather bird-like and sing-song, instead of the clattering, guttural Arabic. I now speak pretty tolerably for a stranger, i.e., I can keep up a conversation and understand all that is said to me much better than I can speak, and follow about half of what people say to each other. When I see you, inshallah, next summer, I shall be a good scholar, I hope. End of letter 48, read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 49 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Austin, Luxor, January 2, 1865. Dearest Mother, I posted a letter for you at Girga as we passed Siut with a good wind. I hope you will get it. My crew worked as I never saw men work. They were paid to get to Luxor, and for 18 days they never rested or slept day or night, and all the time were merry and pleasant. It shows what power of endurance these lazy Arabs have when there is good money at the end of a job, instead of the favorite panacea of stick. We arrived at midnight, and next morning my boat had the air of being pillaged. A crowd of laughing, chattering fellows ran off to the house, laden with loose articles snatched up at random, loaves of sugar, pots and pans, books, cushions, all helter-skelter. I feared breakages, but all was housed safe and sound. The small boys of an age licensed to penetrate into the cabin went off with the oddest cargoes of dressing things and the like, of bakshish not one word. Alhamdulillah Salema. Thank God thou art in peace, and ya sit, ya amira, till my head went round. Old Ishmael fairly hugged me, and little Achmet hung close to my side. I went up to Mustafa's house while the unpacking took place, and breakfasted there, and found letters from all of you. From you to darling Rainey, Sheikh Yusuf was charmed with her big writing, and he said he thought the news in that was the best of all. The weather was intensely hot the first 2 days. Now it is heavenly, a fresh breeze and gorgeous sunshine. I brought two common Arab lanterns for the tube of Abul Hajjaj, and his mulid is now going on. Omar took them and lighted them and told me he found several people who called on the rest to say the Fatah for me. I was sitting out yesterday with the people on the sand looking at the men doing a fantasia on horseback for the Sheikh, and the clever dragoman of the party was relating about the death of a young English girl whom he had served, and so Defia and Aguilla, we talked about the strangers buried here, and how the bishop had extorted £100. I said, Malesh, never mind, the people have been hospitable to me alive, and they will not cease if I die, but give me a tomb among the Arabs. One old man said, May I not see thy day, O lady, and indeed thou shouldest be buried as a daughter of the Arabs, but we should fear the anger of thy consul and thy family, but thou knowest that wherever thou art buried, thou wilt assuredly lie in a Muslim grave. How so? Said I. Why, when a bad Muslim dies, the angels take him out of his tomb and put one in of the good from among the Christians in his place. This is the popular expression of the doctrine that the good are sure of salvation. Omar chimed in at once, Certainly, there is no doubt of it, and I know a story that happened in the days of Muhammad Ali Pasha which proves it. We demanded the story, and Omar began. There was once a very rich man of the Muslims, so stingy that he grudged everybody even so much as a bit of the paper inside the date, Quran. When he was dying, he said to his wife, Go out and buy me a lump of pressed dates. And when she had bought it, he bade her leave him alone. Thereupon he took all his gold out of his sash, and spread it before him, and rolled it up in two or three pieces at a time in the dates, and swallowed it piece after piece, until only three were left, when his wife came in and saw what he was doing, and snatched them from his hand. Presently afterward he fell back and died, and was carried out to the burial place, and laid in his tomb. When the Qadi's men came to put the seal on his property, and found no money, they said, O woman, how is this? We know thy husband was a rich man, and behold, we find no money for his children and slaves or for thee. So the women told what had happened, and the Qadi sent for three other of the ulema, and they decided that, after 3 days, she should go herself into her husband's tomb and open it, and take the money from his stomach. Meanwhile, a guard was put over the tomb to keep away robbers. After 3 days, therefore, the woman went, and the men opened the tomb and said, Go in, O woman, and take thy money. So the woman went down into the tomb alone. When there, instead of her husband's body, she saw a box, coffin, of the boxes of the Christians, and when she opened it, she saw the body of a young girl, adorned with many ornaments of gold necklaces and bracelets, and a diamond curse on her head, and over all a veil of black muslin embroidered with gold. So the woman said within herself, Behold, I came for money, and here it is. I will take it and conceal this business for fear of the Qadi. So she wrapped the whole in her malaya, a blue-checked cotton sheet worn as a cloak, and came out, and the men said, Hast thou done thy business? And she answered, Yes, and returned home. In a few days she gave the veil she had taken from the dead girl to a broker to sell for her in the bazaar, and the broker went and showed it to the people, and was offered 100 piastres. Now there sat in one of the shops of the merchant a great ma'alim, Coptic clerk, belonging to the Pasha, and he saw the veil, and said, How much askest thou? And the broker said, O, thine honour, the clerk, whatever thou wilt. Take from me, then, 500 piastres, and bring the person that gave thee the veil to receive the money. So the broker fetched the woman and the Copt, who was a great man, called the police, and said, Take this woman and fetch my ass, and we will go before the Pasha. And he rode in haste to the palace, weeping and beating his breast, and went before the Pasha, and said, Behold, this veil was buried a few days ago with my daughter, who died unmarried, and I had none but her, and I loved her like my eyes, and would not take from her her ornaments. And this veil she worked herself, and was very fond of it, and she was young and beautiful, and just of the age to be married. And behold, the Muslims go and rob the tombs of the Christians, and if thou wilt suffer this, we Christians will leave Egypt and go and live in some other country, O Effendina, for we cannot endure this abomination. Then the Pasha turned to the woman and said, Woe to thee, O woman! Art thou a Muslimah, and doest such wickedness? And the woman spoke and told all that had happened, and how she sought money, and finding gold had kept it. So the Pasha said, Wait, O Ma'alima, and we will discover the truth of this matter. And he sent for the three ulema, who desired that the tomb should be opened at the end of 3 days, and told them the case, and they said, Open now the tomb of the Christian damsel. and the Pasha sent his men to do so, and when they opened it, beheld it was full of fire, and within it lay the body of the wicked and avaricious Mussulman. Thus it was manifest to all that on the night of terror the angels of God had done this thing, and had laid the innocent girl of the Christians among those who had received direction, and the evil Muslim among the rejected. Admire how rapidly legends arise here. This story, which everybody declared was quite true, is placed no longer ago than in Muhammad Ali Pasha's time. There are hardly any travelers this year, instead of 150 or more boats, perhaps 20. A son of one of the Rothschilds, a boy of 14, has just gone up like a royal prince in one of the Pasha's steamers, all his expenses paid and crowds of attendants. "All that honour to the money of the Jew," said an old fellow to me with a tone of scorn which I could not but echo in my heart. He has turned out his dragoman, a respectable elderly man, very sick, and paid him his bare wages and the munificent sum of £5 to take him back to Cairo. On board there was a doctor and plenty of servants, and yet he abandons the man here on Mustafa's hands. I have brought Er Rashidi here, the sick man, as poor Mustafa is already overloaded with strangers. I am sorry the name of Yahudi, Jew, should be made to stink yet more in the nostrils of the Arabs. I am very well indeed, my cough is almost gone, and I can walk quite briskly and enjoy it. I think, dear mother, I am really better. I never felt the cold so little as this winter since my illness. The chilly mornings and nights don't seem to signify at all now, and the climate feels more delicious than ever. Mr. Herbert, the painter, went back to Cairo from Farshut below Kenna, so I have no Frangie society at all. But Sheikh Yusuf and the Cadi drop into tea very often, and as they are agreeable men, I am quite content with my company. By the by, I will tell you about the tenure of land in Egypt, which the people are always disputing about, as the Cadi laid it down for me. The whole land belongs to the Sultan of Turkey, the Pasha being his vakil, representative, nominally, of course, as we know. Thus there are no owners, only tenants paying from 100 piastres tariff, £1, down to 30 piastres yearly per fedin, about an acre, according to the quality of the land, or the favor of the Pasha when granting it. This tenancy is hereditary to children only, not to collaterals or ascendants, and it may be sold, but in that case application must be made to the government. If the owner or tenant dies childless, the land reverts to the Sultan, i.e. to the Pasha, and if the Pasha chooses to have any man's land, he can take it from him on payment, or without. Don't let anyone tell you that I exaggerate. I have known it to happen. I mean the without, and the man receiving fedin for fedin of desert in return for his good land which he had tilled and watered. Tomorrow night is the great night of Sheikh Abul Hajjaj's Mulid, and I am desired to go to the mosque for the benefit of my health, and that my friends may say a prayer for my children. The kind, hearty welcome I found here has been a real pleasure, and everyone was pleased because I was glad to come home to my Belid town, and they all thought it so nice of my master to have come so far to see me because I was sick. All but one Turk, who clearly looked with pity and contempt on so much trouble taken about a sick old woman. I have left my letter for a long while. You will not wonder, for after some 10 days' fever, my poor guest Mohammed el-Rashidi died today. Two Prussian doctors gave me help for the last 4 days, but left last night. He sank to sleep quietly at noon, with his hand in mine. A good old Muslim sat at his head on one side, and I on the other. Omar stood at his head, and his black boy Khayr at his feet. We had laid his face to the Qibla, and I spoke to him to see if he knew anything, and when he nodded the three Muslims chanted the Islami la ilaha illallah, etc., while I closed his eyes. The respectable men came in by degrees, took an inventory of his property, which they delivered to me, and washed the body, and within an hour and a half we all went out to the burial place, I following among a troop of women who joined us to wail for the brother who had died far from his place. The scene, as we turned in between the broken colossi and the pylons of the temple, to go to the mosque, was overpowering. After the prayer in the mosque, we went out to the graveyard, Muslims and Copts helping to carry the dead, and my Frankish hat in the midst of the veiled and wailing women, all so familiar and yet so strange. After the burial, the Imam, Sheikh Abd el-Waris, came and kissed me on the shoulders, and the Sharif, a man of 80, laid his hands on my shoulders and said, "Fear not, my daughter, neither all the days of thy life nor at the hour of thy death, for God is with thee." I kissed the old man's hand and turned to go, but numberless men came and said, "A thousand thanks, O our sister, for what thou hast done for one among us, and a great deal more." Now the solemn chanting of the fiqhis and the clear voice of the boy reciting the Quran in the room where the man died are ringing through the house. They will pass the night in prayer, and tomorrow there will be the prayer of deliverance in the mosque. Poor Khair has just crept in to have a quiet cry, poor boy. He is in the inventory, and tomorrow I must deliver him up to Les Autorités to be forwarded to Cairo with the rest of the property. He is very ugly, with his black face wet and swollen, but he kisses my hand and calls me his mother quite natural-like. You see, color is no barrier here. The weather is glorious this year, and in spite of some fatigue I am extremely well and strong, and have hardly any cough at all. I am so sorry that the young Rothschild was so hard to Er Rashidi, and that his French doctor refused to come and see him. It makes bad blood, naturally. However, the German doctors were most kind and helpful. The festival of Abu'l-Hajjaj was quite a fine sight, not splendid at all, au contraire, but spirit-stirring, the flags of the sheikh, borne by his family, chanting, and the men tearing about in mimic fight on horseback with their spears. My acquaintance of last year, Abd el-Motouvil, the fanatical sheikh from Tunis, was there. At first he scowled at me. Then someone told him how Rothschild had left Er Rashidi, and he held forth about the hatred of all the unbelievers to the Muslims, and ended by asking where the sick man was. A quaint little smile twinkled in Sheikh Yusuf's soft eyes, and he curled his silky mustache as he said demurely, "Your Honor must go and visit him at the house of the English lady." I am bound to say that the Pharisee executed himself handsomely, for in a few minutes he came up to me and took my hand, and even hoped I would visit the tomb of Abu'l-Hajjaj with him. Since I wrote last I have been rather poorly, more cough and most wearing sleeplessness. A poor young Englishman died here at the house of the Austrian consular agent. I was too ill to go to him, but a kind, dear Englishwoman, a Mrs. Walker, who was here with her family in a boat, sat up with him 3 nights and nursed him like a sister. A young American lay sick at the same time in the house. He is now gone down to Cairo, but I doubt whether he will reach it alive. The Englishman was buried on the first day of Ramadan, where they bury strangers, on the site of a former Coptic church. Archdeacon Moore read the service. Omar and I spread my old flag over the bier, and Copts and Muslims helped to carry the poor stranger. It was a most impressive sight. The party of Europeans, all strangers to the dead but all deeply moved, the group of black-robed and turbaned Copts, the sailors from the boats, the gaily dressed dragomans, several brown-shirted fellaheen, and the thick crowd of children, all the little Arabdas, stark naked and behaving so well, the expression on their faces touched me most of all. As Muslims, Omar and the boatman laid him down in the grave, and while the English prayer was read, the sun went down in a glorious flood of light over the distant bend of the Nile. "Had he a mother, he was young," said an Ababda woman to me with tears in her eyes, and pressing my hand in sympathy for that far-off mother of such a different race. Passenger steamboats now come here every fortnight, but I have had no letter for a month. I have no almanac and have lost count of European time. Today is the 3rd of Ramadan, that is all I know. The poor black slave was sent from Kenna, God knows why, because he had no money and the mudir could not eat off him, as he could off the money and property, he believes. He is a capital fellow, and in order to compensate me for what he eats, he proposed to wash for me, and you would be amused to see Khair with his coal-black face and filed teeth during laundry made out in the yard. He fears the family will sell him, and hopes he may fetch a good price for his boy. Only, on the other hand, he would so like me to buy him, and so his mind is disturbed. Meanwhile, the having all my clothes washed clean is a great luxury. The steamer has come, and I must finish in haste. I have corrected the proofs. There is not much to alter, and though I regret several lost letters, I can't replace them. I tried, but it felt like a forgery. Do you cut out and correct, dearest mother. You will do it much better than I. End of letter 49. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 50 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To the Dowager Lady Duff Gordon. Luxor, January 8, 1865. Dear Old Lady, I received your kind letter in the midst of the drumming and piping and chanting and firing of guns and pistols and scampering of horses, which constitute a religious festival in Egypt. The last day of the Mulid of Abul Hajjaj fell on the 1st January, so you came to wish me may all the year be good to thee, as the people here were civil enough to do when I told them it was the first day of the Frankish year. The Christian year here begins in September. I was very sorry to hear of poor Lady Teresa Lewis's death. I feel as if I had no right to survive people whom I left well and strong when I came away so ill. As usual, the air of Upper Egypt has revived me again, but I am still weak and thin, and hear many lamentations at my altered looks. However, inshallah, thou wilt soon be better. Why don't you make Alexander edit your letters from Spain? I am sure they would be far more amusing than mine can possibly be, for you can write letters, and I never could. I wish I had Miss Berry's, though I never did think her such a genius as most people, but her letters must be amusing from the time when they were written. Alexander will tell you how heavy the hand of Pharaoh is upon this poor people. My father scourged you with whips, but I will scourge you with scorpions. Did not Rehoboam say so? Or I forget which king of Judah. The distress here is frightful in all classes, and no man's life is safe. Ali Bey Retta told me the other day that Prince Arthur is coming here, and that he was coming up with him after taking a prince of Hohenzollern back to Cairo. There will be all the fantasia possible for him here. Every man that has a horse will gallop him to pieces in honor of the son of the Queen of the English, and not a charge of powder will be spared. If you see Layard, tell him that Mustafa Aga had the whole Koran read for his benefit at the tomb of Abul Hajjaj, besides innumerable fatahs which he said for him himself. He consulted me as to the propriety of sending Layard a bakshish, but I declared that Layard was an emir of the Arabs and a giver, not a taker, of bakshish. End of letter 50. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 51 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Austin, Luxor, January 9, 1865. I gave Sheikh Yusuf your knife to cut his kalem, reed pen with, and to his little girl, the coral waistband clasp you gave me, as from you. He was much pleased. I also brought the Sharif, the Psalms in Arabic, to his great delight. The old man called on all our family to say a fatah for their sister, after making us all laugh by shouting out, Alhamdulillah, here is our darling safe back again. I wish you could have seen me in the crowd at Kenna, holding on to the Qadi's faragia, a loose robe worn by the ulema. He is the real original Qadi of the Thousand and One Nights. Did ever Qadi tow an Englishwoman round a sheikh's tomb before? But I thought his determination to show the people that he considered a Christian not out of place in a Muslim holy place very edifying. I find an exceedingly pleasant man here, an Ababda, a very great sheikh from beyond Khartoum, a man of 50, I suppose, with manners like an English nobleman, simple and polite and very intelligent. He wants to take me to Khartoum for 2 months up and back, having a tent and a takhterawan, camel litter, and to show me the Bisharin in the desert. We traced the route on my map, which to my surprise he understood, and I found he had traveled into Zanzibar and knew of the existence of the Cape of Good Hope and the English colony there. He had also traveled in the Dinka and Shuruk country, where the men are 7 feet and over high. Alexander saw a Dinka girl at Cairo 3 inches taller than himself. He knows Mademoiselle Tinet, and says she is on everyone's head and in their eyes, where she has been. You may fancy that I find Sheikh Ali very good company. Today the sand in front of the house is thronged with all the poor people with their camels, of which the government has made a new levy of 8 camels to every 1,000 feddans. The poor beasts are sent off to transport troops in the Sudan, and not being used to the desert, they all die. At all events, their owners never see one of them again. The discontent is growing stronger every day. Last week the people were cursing the Pasha in the streets of Aswan, and everyone talks aloud of what they think. January 11th. The whole place is in desolation. The men are being beaten, one because his camel is not good enough, another because its saddle is old and shabby, and the rest because they have not money enough to pay 2 months' food and the wages of one man to every 4 camels, to be paid for the use of the government beforehand. The courbash has been going on in my neighbors' backs and feet all the morning. It is a new sensation, too, when a friend turns up his sleeve and shows the marks of the wooden handcuffs and the gall of the chain on his throat. The system of wholesale extortion and spoliation has reached a point beyond which it would be difficult to go. The story of Naboth's vineyards is repeated daily on the largest scale. I grieve for Abdallah el-Habashi and the men of high position like him, sent to die by disease or murder in the Fagazo, but I grieve still more over the daily anguish of the poor fellaheen, who are forced to take the bread from the mouths of their starving families, and to eat it while toiling for the private profit of one man. Egypt is one vast plantation where the master works his slaves without even feeding them. From my window now I see the men limping about among the poor camels that are waiting for the Pasha's boats to take them, and the great heaps of maize which they are forced to bring for their food. I can tell you the tears such a sight brings to one's eyes are hot and bitter. These are no sentimental grievances. Hunger and pain and labor without hope and without reward, and the constant bitterness of impotent resentment. To you all this must sound remote and almost fabulous. But try to imagine Farmer Smith's team driven off by the police, and himself beaten till he delivered his hay, his oats, and his farm servant for the use of the Lord Lieutenant, and his 2 sons dragged in chains to work at railway embankments, and you will have some idea of my state of mind today. I fancy from the number of troops going up to Aswan that there is another rising among the blacks. Some of the black regiments revolted up in the Sudan last summer, and now I hear Shaheen Pasha is to be here in a day or two on his way up, and the camels are being sent off by hundreds from all the villages every day. But I am weary of telling, and you will sicken of hearing my constant lamentations. Sheikh Hassan dropped in and dined with me yesterday, and described his mother and her high-handed rule over him. It seems he had a jeunesse orageuse, and she defended him against his father's displeasure, but when the old sheikh died she informed her son that if he ever again behaved in a manner unworthy of a sheikh el-Arab, she would not live to see it. Now if my mother told me to jump into the river and drown, I should say hadr, ready, for I fear her exceedingly, and love her above all people in the world, and have left everything in her hand. He was good enough to tell me that I was the only woman he knew like his mother, and that was why he loved me so much. I am to visit this Arab Deborah at the Ababda village, 2 days' ride from the first cataract. She will come and meet me at the boat. Hassan was splendid when he said how he feared his mother exceedingly. To my amazement today, in walked the tremendous Alim from Tunis, Sheikh Abd el-Motavil, who used to look so black at me. He was very civil and pleasant, and asked no end of questions about steam engines, telegraphs, and chemistry, especially whether it was true that the Europeans still fancied they could make gold. I said that no one had believed that for nearly 200 years, and he said that the Arabs also knew it was a lie, and he wondered to hear that Europeans, who were so clever, believed it. He had just been across the Nile to see the tombs of the kings, and of course improved the occasion and uttered a number of the usual fine sayings about the vanity of human things. He told me I was the only Frank he had ever spoken to. I observed he did not say a word about religion or use the usual pious phrases. By the by, Sheikh Yusuf filled up my inkstand for me the other evening, and in pouring the ink said, Bismillah el-Rahman el-Rahim, in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. I said, I like that custom. It is good to remind us that the ink may be a cruel poison or a good medicine. I am better, and have hardly any cough. The people here think it is owing to the intercession of Abu'l-Hajjaj, who specially protects me. I was obliged to be wrapped in the green silk cover of his tomb when it was taken off to be carried in procession, partly for my health and general welfare, and as a sort of adoption into the family. I made a feeble resistance on the score of being a Nazarenia, but was told, "Never fear, does not God know thee and the sheikh also? No evil will come to thee on that account, but good." And I rather think that general goodwill and kindness is wholesome. End of letter 51, read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 52 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Miss Austin, Luxor, February 7, 1865. My dearest Charlie, I am tolerably well, but I am growing very homesick, or rather children sick. As the time slips on, I get more and more the feeling of all I am losing of my children. We have delicious weather here, and have had it all the time. There has been no cold at all this winter here. Monsieur Prévost Paradol is here for a few days, a very pleasant man indeed, and a little good European talk is a very agreeable interlude to the Arab prosiness, or rather, enfantillage, on the part of the women. I have sought about for shells, and a few have been brought to me from the cataract, but of snails I can learn no tidings, nor have I ever seen one, neither can I discover that there are any shells in the Nile mud. At the first cataract they are found sticking to the rocks. The people here are very stupid about natural objects that are of no use to them. Like with the French, small birds are all sparrows, and wild flowers there are none, and only about 5 varieties of trees in all Egypt. This is a sad year. All the cattle are dead, and the Nile is now as low as it was last July, and the song of the men watering with the shadoofs sounds sadly true as they chant, "Ana ga'an," etc. "I am hungry, I am hungry for a piece of dura bread," sings one, and the other chimes in, "Meskeen, meskeen, poor man, poor man," or else they sing a song about Sayyidina Iyub, our master Job, and his patients. It is sadly appropriate now, and rings on all sides, as the shadoofs are greatly multiplied, for lack of oxen to turn the sakiyas, water wheels. All is terribly dear, and many are sick from sheer weakness owing to poor food, and then I hear 50,000 are to be taken to work at the canal from Giza to Siout through the Fayum. The only comfort is the enormous rise of wages, which, however, falls heavy on the rich. The sailors who got 40 to 50 piastres 5 years ago now get 300 to 500 piastres a month. So I fear I must give up my project of a dahabiyya. If the new French consul-general knows not Joseph and turns me out, I am to live in a new house which Sheikh Yusuf is now building, and of which he would give me the terrace and build 3 rooms on it for me. I wish I got better or worse and can go home. I do get better, but so slowly. I cough a good deal at times, and I am very thin, but not so weak as I was, or so breathless. End of letter 52. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 53 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, Luxor, February 7, 1867. Dearest Alec, I am enjoying a great indulgence of talk with Monsieur Prévost Paradol, as hearty as any nigger. He is a delightful person. This evening he is coming with Eric El Bey, his Armenian companion, and I will invite a few Arabs to show him. I sent off the proofs yesterday per passenger steamer. I trust they will arrive safe. It is too disheartening about letters, so many are lost. I am dreadfully disappointed in my letters. I really don't think them good. You know I don't blagueur about my own performances. I am very glad people like my Cape letters, which I forget, but honestly I don't think the Egyptian good. You know I don't pretend if I think I have done something well, and I was generally content with my translations, but I feel these all to be poor and what Maurice calls dry, when I know how curious and interestingly poetical the country really is. I paid Fadil Pasha a visit on his boat, and it was just like the Middle Ages. In order to amuse me, he called up a horrid little black boy of about 4 to do tricks like a dancing dog, which ended in a performance of the Mussulman prayer. The little beast was dressed in a Stambouli dress of scarlet cloth. All the Arab doctors come to see me now as they go up and down the river to give me help if I want it. Some are very pleasant men. Morid Effendi speaks German exactly like a German. The old Sheikh El Beda of Ermont, who visits me whenever he comes here and has the sweetest voice I ever heard, complained of the climate of Cairo. There is no sun there at all, and it is no brighter or warmer than the moon. What do you think our sun must be now, you know, Cairo? We have had a glorious winter, like the finest summer weather at home, only so much finer. Janet wishes to go with me if I go to Soden. I must make inquiries about the climate. Ross fears it is too cold for an Egyptian like me. I should enjoy to have all the family au grand complet. I will leave Luxor in May and get to you towards the latter part of June, if that pleases you, inshallah. End of letter 53. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 54 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Ross, Luxor, February 7, 1865. Dearest Janet, it is quite heart-rending about my letters. I have got the eye, evidently. The black slave of the poor dragoman who died in my house is still here, and like a dog that has lost his master, has devoted himself to me. It seems nobody's business to take him away, as the Cadi did the money and the goods, and so it looks as if I should quietly inherit poor ugly Cair. He is of a degree of ugliness quite transcendent, with teeth filed sharp in order to eat people, as he says, but the most good-humoured creature and a very fair laundry maid. It is evidently no concern of mine to send him to be sold in Cairo, so I wait the event. If nobody ever claims him, I shall keep him at whatever wages may seem fit, and he will subside into liberty. Du reste, the Maun here says he is legally entitled to his freedom. If the new French consul-general will let me stay on here, I will leave my furniture and come down straight to your hospitable roof in Alexandria, en route for Europe. I fear my plan of a dahabiyah of my own would be too expensive. The wages of common boatmen now are 3 napoleons a month. Monsieur Prévost Pradal, whose company has been a real bonne fortune to me, will speak to the consul-general. I know all Thebes would sign a round-robin in my favour if they only knew how, for I am very popular here, and the only hakim. I have effected some brilliant cures, and get lots of presents, eggs, turkeys, etc., etc. It is quite a pleasure to see how the poor people, instead of trying to sponge on one, are anxious to make a return for kindness. I give nothing whatever but my physic. These country people are very good. A nice young Circassian Kawas sat up with a stranger, a dying Englishman, all night because I had doctored his wife. I have also a pupil, Mustafa's youngest boy, a sweet, intelligent lad who is pining for an education. I wish he could go to England. He speaks English very well and reads and writes indifferently, but I never saw a boy so wild to learn. Is it difficult to get a boy into the Abbasiyah College? As it is gratuitous, I suppose it is. I quite grieve over little Achmet, forced to dawdle away his time and his faculties here. End of letter 54. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 55 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Austin, Luxor, March 13, 1865. Dearest Mother, I hope your mind has not been disturbed by any rumors of battle, murder, and sudden death up in our part of the world. A week ago we heard that a Prussian boat had been attacked, all on board murdered, and the boat burned, then that 10 villages were in open revolt, and that Effendina, the viceroy, himself had come up and taken a broom and swept them clean, i.e. exterminated the inhabitants. The truth now appears to be that a crazy darwish has made a disturbance, but I will tell it as I heard it. He did as his father likewise did 30 years ago, and made himself ism, name by repeating one of the appellations of God, like Ya Latif 3,000 times every night for 3 years, which rendered him invulnerable. He then made friends with the jinn who taught him many more tricks, among others that practiced in England by the Davenports of slipping out of any bonds. He then deluded the people of the desert by giving himself out as El Mahdi, he who is to come with the Lord Jesus and to slay Antichrist at the end of the world, and proclaimed a revolt against the Turks. 3 villages below Kenna, Gao, Rania, and Beda, took part in the disturbance, and Fadl Pasha came up with steamboats, burnt the villages, shot about 100 men, and devastated the fields. At first we heard 1,000 were shot, now it is 100. The women and children will be distributed among other villages. The Darwish, some say, is killed. Others say that he has gone off into the desert with a body of Bedouin and a few of the fellaheen from the 3 ravaged villages. Gao is a large place, as large, I think, as Luxor. The Darwish is a native of Salamia, a village close by here, and yesterday his brother, a very quiet man, and his father's father-in-law, old Haji Sultan, were carried off prisoners to Cairo, or Kenna, we don't know which. It seems that the boat robbed belonged to Greek traders, but no one was hurt, I believe, and no European boat has been molested. Baron Kevenbrink was here yesterday with his wife, and they saw all the sacking of the villages and said no resistance was offered by the people whom the soldiers shot down as they ran, and they saw the sheep, etc., being driven off by the soldiers. You need be in no alarm about me. The Darwish and his followers could not pounce on us, as we are a good 8 miles from the desert, i.e. the mountain, so we must have timely notice, and we have arranged that if they appear in the neighborhood, the women and children of the outlying huts should come into my house, which is a regular fortress, and also any travelers in boats, and we muster a little short of 700 able to fight, including Karnak. Moreover, Fadl Pasha and the troops are at Kenna, only 40 miles off. 3 English boats went down river today, and 1 came up. The Kevenbrinks went up last night. I dined with them. She is very lively and pleasant. I nearly died of laughing today when little Achmet came for his lesson. He pronounced that he was sick of love for her. He played at cards with her yesterday afternoon, and it seems lost his heart. He is 12 and quite a boyish boy, though a very clever one, and he said he was wishing to play a game for a kiss at the stake. He had put on a turban today, on the strength of his passion, to look like a man, and had neglected his dress otherwise, because when young men are sick of love they always do. The fact is the Baroness was kind and amiable, and tried to amuse him as she would have done to a white boy. Hence Achmet's susceptible heart was on fire for her. He also asked me if I had any medicine to make him white, I suppose to look lovely in her eyes. He little knows how very pretty he is with his brown face, as he sits cross-legged on the carpet at my feet in his white turban and blue shirt, reading aloud. He was quite a picture. I have grown very fond of the little fellow. He is so eager to learn and to improve, and so remarkably clever. My little Achmet, who is donkey boy and general little slave, the smallest, slenderest, quietest little creature, has implored me to take him with me to England. I wish Rainie could see him. She would be so apprised at his dark brown little face, so fain, and with eyes like a dormouse. He is a true little Arab, can run all day in the heat, sleeps on the stones and eats anything, quick, gentle, and noiseless, and fiercely jealous. If I speak to any other boy, he rushes at him and drives him away, and while Black Khair was in the house, he suffered martyrdom, and the kitchen was a scene of incessant wrangle about the coffee. Khair would bring me my coffee, and Achmet resented the usurpation of his functions, of course quite hopelessly, as Khair was a great stout black of 18, and poor little Achmet not bigger than Rainie. I am really tempted to adopt the vigilant, active little creature. March 15th. Sheikh Yusuf returned from a visit to Salima last night. He tells me the Darwish Achmet el-Tayyib is not dead. He believes that he is a mad fanatic and a communist. He wants to divide all properly equally, and to kill all the ulema and destroy all theological teachings by learned men, and to preach a sort of revelation or interpretation of the Quran of his own. He would break up your pretty clock, said Yusuf, and give every man a broken wheel out of it, and so with all things. One of the dragomans here had been urging me to go down, But Yusuf laughed at any idea of danger. He says the people here have fought the Bedouin before, and will not be attacked by such a handful as are out in the mountain now. Du reste, the Abu el-Hajjaji, family of Abu el-Hajjaj, will put their seal to it that I am their sister, and answer for me with a man's life. It would be foolish to go down into whatever disturbance there may be alone in a small country boat, and where I am not known. The Pasha himself, we hear, is at Girga with steamboats and soldiers, and if the slightest fear should arise, steamers will be sent up to fetch all the Europeans. What I grieve over is the poor villagers, whose little property is all confiscated, guilty and innocent alike, and many shot as they ran away. Haji Ali tells me privately that he believes the discontent against the government is very deep and universal, and that there will be an outbreak, but not yet. The Pasha's attempt to regulate the price of food by edicts has been very disastrous, and of course the present famine prices are laid to his charge. If a man will be omnipotent, he must take the consequences when he fails. I don't believe in an outbreak. I think the people are too thoroughly accustomed to suffer and to obey. Besides, they have no means of communication, and the steamboats can run up and down and destroy them in detail in a country which is 800 miles long, by from 1 to 8 wide, and thinly peopled. Only Cairo could do anything, and everything is done to please the Cairenes at the expense of the Fellaheen. The great heat has begun these last 3 days. My cough is better, and I am grown fatter again. The Nile is so low now that I fancy that 6 weeks or 2 months hence I shall have to go down in 2 little boats. Even now the dahabiyas keep sticking fast continually. I have promised some neighbors to bring back a little seed corn for them, some of the best English wheat without beard. All the wheat here is bearded, and they have an ambition for some of ours. I long to bring them wheelbarrows and spades and pickaxes. The great folks get steam ploughs, but the laborers work with their bare hands and a rush basket, pour tout potage, and it takes 6 to do the work of one who has got good tools. End of letter 55. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 56 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Ross, Luxor, March 25, 1865. Dearest Janet, I hope you have not had visions of me plundered and massacred by the crazy Darwish who has caused the destruction of Gao and 3 other villages. I assure you we are quite quiet here, and moreover have arranged matters for our defense if Ahmet et Tayyub should honor us with a visit. The heat has just set in, thermometer 89 degrees today. Of course I am much better, fatter, and cough less. Many thanks to Henry about Ahmet ibn Mustafa, but his father is going to send him to England into Mr. Fowler's workshop, which will be a much better training, I think. Mr. Fowler takes him without a premium most kindly. Lord Dudley will tell you what a splendid entertainment I gave him. I think he was quite frightened at the sight of the tray and the black fingers in the dishes. The Arabda Sheikh and his handsome brother proposed to take me to the Mulid of Sheikh el-Shadhili, the coffee saint, in the desert to see all the wild Ababda and Bishareya. It is very tempting. If I feel pretty well, I must go, I think, and perhaps the change might do me good. They believe no European ever went to that festival. There are camel races and a great show of pretty girls, says the handsome Hassan. A fine young Circassian Kawas here has volunteered to be my servant anywhere and to fight anybody for me, because I have cured his pretty wife. You would love Khurshid with his clear blue eyes, fair face, and brisk, neat, soldierly air. He has a Crimean medal, and such a lot of daggers and pistols, and is such a tremendous Muslim, but nevertheless he loves me, and tells me all his affairs, and how tiresome his wife's mother is. I tell him all wives' mothers always are, but he swears Wahali, Hawaga, Mr. Ross, don't say so, Wahali, inshallah. End of letter 56. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 57 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon. Luxor, March 30, 1865. Dearest Alec, I have just received your letter of March 3rd with one from Janet, which shows of how little moment the extermination of four villages is in this country, for she does not allude to our revolt and evidently has not heard of it. In my last letter to Mutter, I told how one Achmet at Tayib, a mad darwish, had raised a riot at Gao below Kenna, and how a boat had been robbed, and how we were all rather looking out for a razzia and determined to fight Achmet at Tayib and his followers. Then we called the Haramhi, wicked ones, and were rather bloodthirstily disposed towards them, and resolved to keep order and protect our property. But now we say Nas Mesakin, poor people, and whisper to each other that God will not forget what the Pasha has done. The truth, of course, we shall never know. But I do know that one Pasha said he had hanged 500, and another that he had sent 300 to Fazaglo, Kamki Dura Kayin, and all for the robbery of one Greek boat in which only the steersman was killed. I cannot make out that anything was done by the insurgents beyond going out into the desert to listen to the darwish's nonsense, and see a reed shaken by the wind. The party that had robbed the boat was, I am told, about 40 strong. But the most horrid stories are current among the people of the atrocities committed on the wretched villagers by the soldiers. Not many were shot, they say, and they attempted no resistance, but the women and girls were outraged and murdered, and the men hanged, and the steamers loaded with plunder. The worst is that every one believes the Europeans aid and abet, and all declare that the Copts were spared to please the Frangis. Mind, I am not telling you facts, only what the people are saying, in order to show you their feelings. One most respectable young man sat before me on the floor the other day, and told me what he had heard from those who had come up the river. Horrible tales of the stench of the bodies which were left unburied by the Pasha's order, of women big with child ripped open, etc., etc. Thou knowest, O our Lady, that we are a people of peace in this place, and behold now, if one madman should come and a few idle fellows go out to the mountain, desert with him, Effendina will send his soldiers to destroy the place and spoil our poor little girls and hang us. Is that right, O Lady? And Ahmed el-Barbary saw Europeans with hats in the steamer with Effendina in the soldiers. Truly, in all the world, none are miserable like us Arabs. The Turks beat us, and the Europeans hate us, and say, quite right. By God, we had better lay down our heads in the dust, die, and let the strangers take our land and grow cotton for themselves. As for me, I am tired of this miserable life, and of fearing for my poor little girls. Mohammed was really eloquent, and when he threw his malaya over his face and sobbed, I am not ashamed to say that I cried too. I know very well that Mohammed was not quite right in what he says of the Europeans. I know the cruel old platitudes about governing Orientals by fear, which the English pick up like mockingbirds from the Turks. I know all about the stick and vigor and all that, but I sit among the people, and I know, too, that Mohammed feels just as John Smith or Tom Brown would feel in his place, and that men who were very savage against the riders in the beginning are now almost in a humor to rise against the Turks themselves, just exactly as free-born Britons might be. There are even men of the class who have something to lose who express their disgust very freely. I saw the steamer pass up to Fazoglo, but the prisoners were all below. The Sheikh of the Ababda here has had to send a party of his men to guard them through the desert. Altogether this year is miserable in Egypt. I have not once heard the Zagarit. Everyone is anxious and depressed, and I fear hungry. The land is parched from the low Nile. The heat has set in 6 weeks earlier than usual. The animals are scarecrows for want of food, and now these horrid stories of bloodshed and cruelty and robbery, for the Pasha takes the lands of these villages for his own, have saddened every face. I think Haji Ali is right, and that there will be more disturbances. If there are, they will be caused by the cruelty and oppression at Gao and the three neighboring villages. From Salamea, 2 miles above Luxor, every man, woman, and child in any degree kin to Achmet at Tayib has been taken in chains to Kenna, and no one here expects to see one of them return alive. Some are remarkably good men, I hear, and I have heard men say, if Haji Sultan is killed, and all his family, we will never do a good action any more, for we see it is of no use. There was a talk among the three or four Europeans here at the beginning of the rumors of a revolt of organizing a defense among Christians only. Conceive what a silly and gratuitous provocation! There was no religion in the business at all, and of course the proper person to organize a defense was the Maon, and he and Mustafa and others had planned using my house as a castle and defending that in case of a visit from the rioters. I have no doubt the true cause of the row is the usual one, hunger, the high price of food. It was like our swing or bread riots, nothing more, and a very feeble affair, too. It is curious to see how the travellers' gay dahabiyas, just as usual, and the Europeans as far removed from all care or knowledge of the distresses as if they were at home. When I go and sit with the English, I feel almost as if they were foreigners to me, too, so completely am I now Dint el Belid, daughter of the country, here. I dined 3 days running with the Kevenbrinks, and one day after dinner we sent for a lot of Arab sheikhs to come for coffee. The two Ababda, and a relation of theirs from Khartoum, the Sheikh of Karnak, one Mohammed, a rich fella, and we were joined by the Aga of Halim Pasha's harem, and an ugly beast he is. The little Baroness won all hearts. She is a regular vive argent, or, as we say, ifrita, and to see the dark faces glittering with merry smiles as they watched her was very droll. I never saw a human being so thoroughly amused as the black sheikh from the Sudan. Next day we dined at the Austrian agent's, and the Baroness at last made the Maon dance a polka with her while the agent played the guitar. There were a lot of cops about who nearly died of laughing, and indeed so did I. Next day we had a capital dinner at Mustafa's, and the two Ababda sheikhs, the Sheikh of Karnak, the Maon, and Sheikh Yusuf dined with us. The Sheikh of Karnak gave a grand performance of eating like a Bedouin. I have heard you talk of tripas elasticas in Spain, but Wahali, anything like the performance of Sheikh Abdallah none but an eyewitness could believe. How he plucked off the lamb's head and handed it to me in token of the highest respect, and how the bones crackled beneath his fingers, how huge handfuls of everything were chucked right down his throat all scorching hot. I encouraged him, of course, quoting the popular song about doing deeds that Antar did not, and we all grew quite uproarious. When Sheikh Abdallah asked for drink, I cried, "Bring the balari, the big jar the women fetch water in, for the sheikh." And Sheikh Yusuf compared him to Samson and to Og, while I more profanely told how Antar broke the bones and threw them about. The little Baroness was delighted and only expressed herself hurt that no one had crammed anything into her mouth. I told the Maon her disappointment, which caused more laughter, as such a custom is unknown here, but he, of course, made no end of sweet speeches to her. After dinner she showed the Arabs how ladies curtsy to the Queen in England, and the Ababda acted the ceremonial of presentation at the court of Darfur, where you have to rub your nose in the dust at the King's feet. Then we went out with lanterns and torches, and the Ababda did the sword dance for us. Two men with round shields and great swords do it. One dances a pas seul of challenge and defiance with prodigious leaps and pirouettes and ha-has. Then the other comes, and a grand fight ensues. When the handsome Sheikh Hassan, whom you saw in Cairo, bounded out, it was really heroic. All his attitudes were alike grand and graceful. They all wanted Sheikh Yusuf to play El Nebut, single stick, and said he was the best man here at it, but his sister was not long dead and he could not. Hassan looks forward to Maurice's coming here to teach him the fighting of the English. How Maurice would pound him! On the fourth night I went to tea in Lord Hopeton's boat, and their sailors gave a grand fantasia excessively like a Christmas pantomime. One danced like a woman, and there was a regular pantaloon, only more so, and a sort of clown in sheepskin and a pink mask who was duly tumbled about, and who distributed clacks freely with a huge wooden spoon. It was very good fun indeed, though it was quite as well that the ladies did not understand the dialogue, or that part of the dance which made the Maon roar with laughter. The Hopetuns had two handsome boats and were living like in Mayfair. I am so used now to our poor shabby life that it makes quite a strange impression on me to see all that splendor which a year or two ago I should not have even remarked, and thus out of my inward consciousness, as Germans say, many of the peculiarities and faults of the people of Egypt are explained to me and accounted for. April 2nd. It is so dreadfully hot and dusty that I shall rather hasten my departure if I can. And as all the land which last year was green is now desert and dry, the dust is four times as bad. If I hear that Ross has bought and sent up a dahabiyya, I will wait for that. If not, I will go in 3 weeks if I can. End of letter 57. Read by Spella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 58 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Austin, Luxor, April 3, 1865. Dearest Mother, I have just finished a letter to Alec to go by a steamer today. You will see it, so I will go on with the stories about the riots. Here is a thing happening within a few weeks and within 60 miles, and already the events assume a legendary character. Ahmed et Taib is not dead, and where the bullets hit him he shows little marks like burns. The affair began thus. A certain Copt had a Muslim slave girl who could read the Koran and who served him. He wanted her to be his harem, and she refused, and went to Ahmed et Taib, who offered money for her to her master. He refused it, and insisted on his rights, backed by the government, and thereupon Ahmed proclaimed a revolt, and the people, tired of taxes and oppressions, said, "We will go with thee." This is the only bit of religious legend connected with the business. But Ahmed et Taib still sits in the island, invisible to the Turkish soldiers who are still there. Now for a little fact. The man who told me 1400 had been beheaded was Hassan Sheikh of the Ababda, who went to Gao to bring up the prisoners. The boat stopped a mile above Luxor, and my Mohammed, a most quiet, respectable man, and not at all a romancier, went up in her to El Montana. I rode with him along the island. When we came near the boat, she went on as far as the point of the island, and I turned back after only looking at her from the bank, and smelling the smell of a slave ship. It never occurred to me, I own, that the bey on board had fled before a solitary woman on a donkey, but so it was. He told the Ababda Sheikh on board not to speak to me or to let me on board, and told the captain to go a mile or two further. Mohammed heard all this. He found on board 100 prisoners less 2, 98. Among them the mudir of Sahaj, a Turk, in chains and wooden handcuffs like the rest. Mohammed took him some coffee and was civil to him. He says the poor creatures are dreadfully ill-used by the Ababda and the Nubians, Barbary, who guard them. It is more curious than you can conceive to hear all the people say. It is just like going back 4 or 5 centuries at least, but with a heterogeneous element of steamers, electric telegraphs, and the bey's dread of the English lady's pen. At least Mohammed attributed his flight to fear of that weapon. It was quite clear that the European eyes were dreaded, as the boat stopped 3 miles above Luxor and its dahabiyas, and had all its things carried at that distance. Yusuf and his uncle want to take me next year to Mecca. The good folks in Mecca would hardly look for a heretical face under the green veil of a Sharifata of Abul Hajjaj. The Hajis, pilgrims, have just started from here to Kosir with camels and donkeys, but most are on foot. They are in great numbers this year. The women chanted and drummed all night on the river bank, and it was fine to see 50 or 60 men in a line praying after their imam, with the red glow of the sunset behind them. The prayer in common is quite a drill and very stately to see. There are always quite as many women as men. One wonders how they stand the march and the hardships. My little Ahmed grows more pressing with me to take him. I will take him to Alexandria, I think, and leave him in Janet's house to learn more house service. He is a dear little boy and very useful. I don't suppose his brother will object, and he has no parents. Ahmed ibn Mustafa also coaxes me to take him with me to Alexandria, and to try to persuade his father to send him to England to Mr. Fowler. I wish most heartily I could. He is an uncommon child in every way, full of ardor to learn and do something, and yet childish and winning and full of fun. His pretty brown face is quite a pleasure to me. His remarks on the New Testament teach me as many things as I can teach him. The boy is pious, and not at all ill-taught. He is much pleased to find so little difference between the teachings of the Koran and the Angil. He wanted me, in case Omar did not go with me, to take him to serve me. Here there is no idea of its being derogatory for a gentleman's son to wait on one who teaches him. It is positively incumbent. He does all menial offices for his mother, hands coffee, waits at table, or helps Omar in anything if I have company. Nor will he eat or smoke before me, or sit till I tell him. It is like service in the Middle Ages. End of letter 58. read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 59 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon, read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Ross, Luxor, April 3, 1865. Dearest Janet, the weather has set in so horrid, as to dust, that I shall be glad to get away as soon as I can. If you have bought a dahabiyah for me, of course I will await its arrival. If not, I will have two small boats from Kenna, whereby I shall avoid sticking in this very low water. Sheikh Hassan goes down in his boat in 20 days, and urges me to travel under his escort, as of course the poor devils who are out on their keeping after the Gaub business have no means of living left but robbery, and Sheikh Hassan's party is good for 7 or 8 guns. You will laugh at my listening to such a cowardly proposition on my part, but my friends here are rather bent upon it, and Hassan is a capital fellow. If, therefore, the dahabiyah is in rerum naturae and can start at once, well and good. April 14th. The dahabiyah sounds an excellent bargain to me, and good for you also to get your people to Aswan first. Many thanks for the arrangement. Your version of our massacre is quite curious to us here. I know very intimately the Sheikh el Arab who helped catch the poor people, and also a young Turk who stood by, while Fadil Pasha had the men laid down by 10 at a time and chopped with pioneers' axes. My Turkish friend, a very good-humoured young fellow, quite admired the affair and expressed a desire to do likewise to all the fellaheen in Egypt. I have seen with my own eyes a second boatload of prisoners. I wish to God the Pasha knew the deep exasperation which his subordinates are causing. I do not like to say all I hear. As to Ulema, Cadiz, Muftis, etc., I know from many towns and villages, and all say we are Muslims, but we should thank God to send Europeans to govern us. The feeling is against the government and the Turks up here, not against Christians. A Coptic friend of mine has lost all his uncle's family at Gao. All were shot down, Copt and Christian alike. As to Haji Sultan, who lies in chains at Kenna and his family up at Esna, a better man never lived, nor one more liberal to Christians. Copts ate of his bread as freely as Muslims. He lies there because he is distantly related by marriage to Ahmet at Taib. The real reason is because he is wealthy and some enemy covets his goods. Ask Monsieur Mounier what he knows. Perhaps I know even more of the feelings, as I am almost adopted by the Abul Hajijia, and sit every evening with some party or another of decent men. I assure you I am in despair at all I see, and if the soldiers do come it will be worse than the cattle disease. Are not the Kawasas bad enough? Do they not buy in the market at their own prices and beat the Sakas in sole payment for the skins of water? Who denies it here? Cairo is like Paris. Things are kept sweet there, but up here... Of course, Effendina hears the smooth prophecies of the tyrants whom he sees up river. When I wrote before, I knew nothing of a certain, but now I have eyewitnesses' testimony, and I say that the Pasha deceives or is deceived. I hope the latter. An order from him did stop the slaughter of women and children, which Fadil Pasha was about to effect. To turn to less wretched matters, I will come right down Alexandria with the boat. I shall rejoice to see you again. Possibly the Ababda may come with me, and I hope Sheikh Yusuf, my chaplain, as Arthur Taylor called him. We shall be quite a little fleet. End of letter 59. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 60 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, April 1865. Dearest Alexander, yesterday was the Bairam, I rejoice to say, and I have lots of physic to make up for all the stomachs damaged by Ramadan. I have persuaded Mr. Fowler, the engineer, who was with Lord Dudley, to take my dear little pupil Ahmet, son of Ibn Mustafa, to learn the business at Leeds instead of idling in his father's house here. I will give the child a letter to you in case he should go to London. He has been reading the Gospels with me at his own desire. I refused till I had asked his father's consent, and Sheikh Yusuf, who heard me, begged me by all means to make him read it carefully, so as to guard him against the heretical inventions he might be beset with among the English of the vulgar sort. What a poser for a missionary! I sent down the poor black lad with Arakil Bey. He took leave of me with his ugly face all blubbered like a sentimental hippopotamus. He said for himself he wished to stay with me, but then what would his boy, his little master, do? There was only a stepmother who would take all the money, and who else would work for the boy? Little Achmet was charmed to see Khair go, of whom he chose to be horribly jealous, and to be wroth at all he did for me. Now the Sheikh el-Balad of Badia has carried off my watchman, and the Christian Sheikh el-Hara of our quarter of Luxor has taken the boy Yusuf for the canal. The former I successfully resisted, and got back Mansur, not indeed in Columas, for he had been handcuffed and bastinadoed to make me pay 200 piastres, but he bore it like a man rather than ask me for the money, and was thereupon surrendered. But the Copt will be a tougher business. He will want more money and be more resolved to get it. Verimus, I must, I suppose, go to the Nazir at the canal, a Turk, and beg off my donkey boy. I saw Hassan Sheikh al-Ababda yesterday, who was loud in praise of your good looks and gracious manners. Mashallah, thy master is a sweet man, O lady. Yesterday was Biram, and lots of harem came in their best clothes to wish me a happy year, and enjoyed themselves much with sweet cakes, coffee, and pipes. Khurshid's wife, whom I cured completely, looked very handsome. Khurshid is a Circassian, a fine young fellow, much shot and hacked about with the Crimean medal. He was Kawas here, and a great friend of mine. He says if I ever want a servant he will go with me anywhere and fight anybody, which I don't doubt in the least. He was a Turkish memluk, and his condescension in wishing to serve a Christian woman is astounding. His fair face and clear blue eyes, and brisk, neat, soldier-like air, contrast curiously with the brown fellaheen. He is like an Englishman, only fairer, and like them too fond of the courbash. What would you say if I appeared in Germany, attended by a memluk with pistols, sword, dagger, carbine, and courbash, and, with a decided and imperious manner, the very reverse of the Arab softness, and such a Muslim, too, prays 5 times a day and extra fasts besides Ramadan? I beat my wife, said Khurshid. Oh, I beat her well. She talked so, and I am like the English. I don't like too many words. He was quite surprised that I said I was glad my master didn't dislike talking so much. I was talking the other day with Yusuf about people trying to make converts, and I said that eternal bêtise. Oh, they mean well. True, O lady, perhaps they do mean well, but God says in the noble Qur'an that he who injures or torments those Christians whose conduct is not evil, merely on account of religion, shall never smell the fragrance of the garden, paradise. Now, when men begin to want to make others change their faith, it is extremely hard for them not to injure or torment them, and therefore I think it better to abstain altogether, and to wish rather to see a Christian a good Christian, and a Muslim a good Muslim. No wonder a most pious old Scotchman told me that the truth which undeniably existed in the Mussulman faith was the work of Satan and the Ulema, his ministers. My dear saint of a Yusuf, a minister of Satan! I really think I have learnt some Muslim humility, in that I endured the harangue, and accepted a twopenny tract quite mildly and politely, and didn't argue at all. As his friend Satan would have it, the Fikis were reading the Koran in the hall at Omar's expense, who gave a khatma that day, and Omar came in and politely offered him some sweet prepared for the occasion. I have been really amazed at several instances of English fanaticism this year. Why do people come to a Muslimin country with such bitter hatred in their stomachs, as I have seen 3 or 4 times? I feel quite hurt often at the way people here thank me for what the poor at home would turn up their noses at. I hardly think a dragoman has been up the river since Rashidi died, but has come to thank me as warmly as if I had done himself some great service, and many to give some little present. While the man was ill, members of the fellaheen brought eggs, pigeons, etc., etc., even a turkey, and food is worth money now, not as it used to be. I am quite weary, too, of hearing, "Of all the Frangi, I never saw one like thee." Was no one at all ever humane before? For remember, I give no money, only a little physic and civility. How the British cottagers would thank ye for nothing, and how I wish my neighbors here could afford to do the same. After much wrangling, Mustafa has got back my boy Yusuf, but the Christian Sheikh el-Hara has made his brother pay 2 pounds, whereat Mohammed looks very rueful. 200 men are gone out of our village to the works, and of course the poor harem have not bread to eat, as the men had to take all they had with them. I send you a very pretty story like Tannhauser. There was once a man who loved a woman that lived in the same quarter. But she was true to her husband, and his love was hopeless, and he suffered greatly. One day, as he lay on his carpet, sick with love, one came to him and said, "Oh, such a one, thy beloved has died even now, and they are carrying her out to the tomb." So the lover arose and followed the funeral, and hid himself near the tomb, and when all were gone he broke it open, and uncovered the face of his beloved, and looked upon her, and passion overcame him, and he took from the dead that which when living she had ever denied him. But he went back to the city and to his house in great grief and anguish of mind, and his sin troubled him. So he went to a Qadi, very pious and learned in the noble Qur'an, and told him his case, and said, "O my master the Qadi, can such a one as I obtain salvation and the forgiveness of God? I fear not." And the Qadi gave him a staff of polished wood which he held in his hand, and said, "Who knoweth the mercy of God and his justice, but God alone? Take then this staff, and stick it in the sand beside the tomb, where thou didst sin, and leave it the night, and go next morning, and come and tell me what thou shalt find, and may the Lord pardon thee, for thy sin is great." And the man went and did as the Qadi had desired, and went again at sunrise, and behold, the staff had sprouted and was covered with leaves and fruit. And he returned and told the Qadi what had happened, and the Qadi replied, "Praise be to God, the merciful, the compassionate." End of letter 60, read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 61 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon, read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Austin, Luxor, April 29, 1865. Dearest Mutter, since I wrote last, I have received the box with the cheese quite fresh, and very good it tastes, and the various things. Nothing called forth such a shout of joy for me as your photo of the village pothouse. How green and fresh and tidy! Many mashallahs have been uttered over the Bayt el-Fellahin, peasant's house of England. The railings especially are a great marvel. I have also heard from Janet that Ross has bought me a boat for £200, which is to take four of his agents to Aswan and then come back for me. So all my business is settled, and inshallah I shall depart in another 3 or 4 weeks. The weather is quite cool and fresh again, but the wind's very violent, and the dust pours over us like water from the dried-up land, as well as from the Guma mountain. It is miserably uncomfortable, but my health is much better again, in spite of all. The Hakim business goes on at a great rate. I think, on an average, I have 4 sick a day, sometimes a dozen. A whole gypsy camp are great customers. The poor souls will bring all manner of gifts. It goes to my heart to eat, but they can't bear to be refused. They are astounded to hear that people of their blood live in England, and that I knew many of their customs, which are the same here. Khurshid Aga came to take final leave, being appointed to Kenna. He had been at Gao, and had seen Fadil Pasha sit and make the soldiers lay 60 men down on their backs, by 10 at a time, and chop them to death with their prisoners' axes. He estimated the people killed, men, women, and children, at 1,600. But Mounier tells me it was over 2,000. Sheikh Hassan agreed exactly with Khurshid, only the Arab was full of horror and the Circassian full of exultation. His talk was exactly what we all once heard about pandies, and he looked and talked and laughed so like a fine young English soldier that I was ashamed to call him the kelb, dog, which rose to my tongue, and I bestowed it on Fadil Pasha instead. I must also say in behalf of my own countrymen that they had provocation, while here there was none. Poor Hagi Sultan lies in chains at Kenna, one of the best and kindest of men. I am to go and take secret messages to him, and money from certain men of religion to bribe the mudir with. The Sharafa, who have asked me to do this, are from another place, as well as a few of the Abul Hajijia. A very great Sharif indeed from Lower Egypt said to me the other day, "Thou knowest if I am a Muslim or no. Well, I pray to the Most Merciful to send us Europeans to govern us, and to deliver us from these wicked men." We were all sitting after the funeral of one of the Sharufa, and I was sitting between the Sharif of Luxor and the Imam, and this was said before 30 or 40 men, all Sharufa. No one said no, and many assented aloud. The Sharif asked me to lend him the New Testament. It was a pretty copy, and when he admired it I said, "For me to thee, O my master the Sharif, write in it as we do in remembrance of a friend, the gift of a Nazrinia who loves the Muslimin." The old man kissed the book and said, "I will write, moreover, to a Muslim who loves all such Christians," and after this the old Sheikh of Abu Ali took me aside and asked me to go as messenger to Hagi Sultan, for if one of them took the money it would be taken from them, and the man get no good by it. Soldiers are now to be quartered in the Said, a new plague worse than all the rest. Do not the Kawasas already rob the poor enough? They fix their own price in the market and beat the Sakas as sole payment. What will the soldiers do? The taxes are being illegally levied on lands which are Shiraji, i.e. totally unwatered by the last Nile, and therefore exempt by law, and the people are driven to desperation. I feel sure there will be more troubles as soon as there arises any other demagogue like Ahmed At-Taib to incite the people, and now every Arab sympathizes with him. Janet has written to me the Cairo version of the affair, cooked for the European taste, and monstrous it is. The Pasha accuses some sheikh of the Arabs of having gone from Upper Egypt to India to stir up the mutiny against us. Pourquoi pas, to conspire in Paris or London? It is too childish to talk of a poor Saidi Arab going to a country of whose language and whereabouts he is totally ignorant, in order to conspire against people who never heard him. You may suppose how Yusuf and I talk by ourselves of all these things. He urged me to try hard to get my husband here as consul general, assuming that he would feel as I do. I said, "My master is not young, and to a just man the wrong of such a place would be a martyrdom." "Truly thou hast said it, but it is a martyr we Arabs want. Shall not the reward of him who suffers daily vexation for his brethren's sake be equal to that of him who dies in battle for the faith? If thou wert a man, I would say to thee, take the labor and sorrow upon thee, and thine own heart will repay thee." He too said, like the old sheikh, "I only pray for Europeans to rule us. Now the fellaheen are really worse off than any slaves. I am sick of telling the daily oppressions and robberies. If a man has a sheep, the mudir comes and eats it. If a tree, it goes to the nazir's kitchen. My poor Saka is beaten by the Kawases in sole payment of his skins of water, and then people wonder my poor friends tell lies and bury their money. I now know everybody in my village, and the cunning women have set up the theory that my eye is lucky, so I am asked to go and look at young brides, visit houses that are building, inspect cattle, etc., as a bringer of good luck, which gives me many a curious sight. I went a few days ago to the wedding of handsome Sheikh Hassan the Ababda, who married the butcher's pretty little daughter. The group of women and girls, lighted by the lantern, which Ahmet carried up for me, was the most striking thing I have seen. The bride, a lovely girl of 10 or 11, all in scarlet, a tall dark slave of Hassan's, blazing with gold and silver necklaces and bracelets, with long twisted locks of coal-black hair, and such glittering eyes and teeth, the wonderful wrinkled old woman, and the pretty, wondering, yet fearless children were beyond description. The mother brought the bride up to me and unveiled her, and asked me to let her kiss my hand, and to look at her. I said all the usual Bismillah mashallahs, and after a time went to the men who were eating, all but Hassan, who sat apart, and begged me to sit by him, and whispered anxious inquiries about his Arusha's looks. After a time he went to visit her, and returned in half an hour very shy, and covering his face and hand, and kissed the hands of the chief guests. Then we all departed, and the girl was taken to look at the Nile, and then to her husband's house. Last night he gave me a dinner, a very good dinner indeed, in his house, which is equal to a very poor cattle shed at home. We were only five. Sheikh Yusuf, Omar, an elderly merchant, and I. Hassan wanted to serve us, but I made him sit. The merchant, a well-bred man of the world who has enjoyed life and married wives everywhere, had arrived that day and found a daughter of his dead here. He said he felt very miserable, and everyone told him not to mind, and consoled him, oddly enough, to English ideas. Then people told stories. Omar's was a good version of the man and wife who would not shut the door and agreed that the first to speak should do it. Very funny indeed. Yusuf told a pretty tale of a sultan who married a Bint el-Arab, daughter of the Bedawi, and how she would not live in his palace, and said she was no fellaha to dwell in houses, and scorned his silk clothes and sheep killed for her daily, and made him live in the desert with her. A black slave told a prosy tale about thieves, and the rest were more long than pointed. Hassan's Arab feelings were hurt at the small quantity of meat set before me. They can't kill a sheep now for an honored guest. But I told him no greater honor could be paid to us English than to let us eat lentils and onions like one of the family, so that we might not feel as strangers among them, which delighted all the party. After a time the merchant told us his heart was somewhat dilated, as a man might say his toothache had abated, and we said praise be to God all around. A short time ago my poor friend the Maun had a terrible tile fall on his head. His wife, two married daughters, and 9 miscellaneous children arrived on a sudden, and the poor man is now tasting the pleasures which Abraham once endured between Sarah and Hagar. I visited the ladies and found a very ancient Sarah and a daughter of wonderful beauty. A young man here, a sharif, has asked me to open negotiations for a marriage for him with the Maun's granddaughter, a little girl of 8, so you see how completely I am one of the family. My boat has not yet made its appearance. I am very well indeed now, in spite, or perhaps because of, the great heat. But there is a great deal of sickness, chiefly dysentery. I never get less than 4 new patients a day, and my practice has become quite a serious business. I spent all day on Friday in the Ababda quarters, where Sheikh Hassan and his slave Rama were both uncommonly ill. Both are all right now. Rama is the nicest negro I ever knew, and a very great friend of mine. He is a most excellent, honest, sincere man, and an effendi, i.e., writes and reads, which is more than his master can do. He has seen all the queer people in the interior of Africa. The Sheikh of the Bisharin, 8 days' journey from Aswan, has invited me and promises me all the milk and meat I can eat. They have nothing else. They live on a high mountain and are very fine, handsome people. If only I were strong, I could go to very odd places where Frangies are not. Read a very stupid novel, as a story, called Le Secret du Bonheur. It gives the truest impression of the manners of Arabs that I have read, by Ernest Feydeau. According to his book, Ashut, we are brothers. The caressant ways of Arabs are so well described. It is the same here. The people come and pat and stroke me with their hands, and one corner of my brown abaya is faded with much kissing. I am hailed as Sit Betana, our own lady, and now the people are really enthusiastic because I refused the offer of some kawasas as a guard which a bimbashi made me. As if I would have such fellows to help bully my friends! The said bimbashi, next in rank to a bey, a coarse man like an arnut, stopped here a day and a night and played his little Turkish game, telling me to beware, for the ulema hated all Franks and set the people against us, and telling the Arabs that Christian hakims were all given to poison Muslims. So at night I dropped in at the Maun's with Sheikh Yusuf carrying my lantern, and was loudly hailed with Assalam alayki from the old sharif himself, who began praising the gospel I had given him, and me at the same time. Yusuf had a little reed in his hand, the kalim for writing, about 2 feet long and the size of a quill. I took it and showed it to the bimbashi and said, "Behold the nebut wherewith we are all to be murdered by this sheikh of the religion." The bimbashi's bristly moustache bristled savagely, for he felt that the Arab dogs and the Christian kanzira, feminine pig, were laughing at it together. Another steamboat load of prisoners from Gao has just gone up. A little comfort is derived here from the news that, praise be to God, Musa Pasha, governor of the Sudan, is dead and gone to hell. It must take no trifle to send him there, judging by the quiet way in which Fadil Pasha is mentioned. You will think me a complete rebel, but I may say to you what most people would think like my nonsense, that one's pity becomes a perfect passion when one sits among the people, as I do, and sees it all. Least of all can I forgive those among Europeans and Christians who can help to break these bruised reeds. However, in Cairo and more still in Alexandria, all is quite different. There the same system which has been so successfully copied in France prevails. The capital is petted at the expense of the fellaheen. Prices are regulated in Cairo for meat and bread as they are or were in Paris, and the dangerous classes enjoy all sorts of exemptions. Just like France, the Cairenes eat the bread and the fellaheen the stick. The people here used to dislike Mounier, who arrived poor and grew rich and powerful, But they all bless him now, and say, at El Montana, a man eats his own meat, and not the courbash of the mudir. And Mounier has refused soldiers, as I refuse them on my small account, and please God he will never repent it. Yusuf says, what the Turkish government fears is not for your safety, but lest we should learn to love you too well. And it is true. Here there is but one voice, let the Franks come, and let us have the laws of the Christians. In Cairo the Franks have dispelled this douce illusion, and done the Turks' work as if they were paid for it. But here come only travellers who pay with money and not with stick, a degree of generosity not enough to be adored. I perceive that I am a boor, but you will forgive my indignant sympathy with the kind people who treat me so well. Yusuf asked me to let the English papers know about the Gao business. An Alim ed-Din-u-Islam would fain call for help to the Times. Strange changes and signs of the times, these, are they not so? I went to church on Good Friday with the Copts. The scene was very striking, the priest dressed like the beautiful crusader in white robes with crimson crosses. One thing has my hearty admiration. The few children who are taken to church are allowed to play. Oh, my poor little Protestant fellow Christians, can you conceive a religion so delightful as that which permits Peep Bo behind the curtains of the sanctuary? I saw little Brutus and Scandaria at it at church time, and the priest only patted their little heads as he carried the sacrament out to the harem. Fancy the parson kindly patting a noisy boy's head instead of the beadle whacking him. I am entirely reconciled to the Coptic rules. End of letter 61. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.